I've got in front of me the description of what I said I would be doing now. I've called it Jewish Agnostic Prayer, and I think I'd just like to open it up, first of all, just to get some sort of feedback from you as to what you think it might be that I'm talking about, and how it resonates or doesn't resonate. Anybody like to kick off? It's a bit unfair. I'm supposed to start, and I'm asking you to start. Jewish Agnostic Prayer. Is it full of contradictions or not?
I think it's about being wanting to be part of a group, struggling with the belief bit, but wanting to sort of rehearse the steps that you hope will eventually form a dance that you can actually relate to, and therefore will encourage you into believing the words that are written in the book.
Right. Okay. Thank you. Anybody want to sort of, you know, pick up on that, add to it, or go in a different direction altogether?
Doubtful optimism.
Doubtful optimism.
Mm. I'm not sure whether it has any effect, but you'll hope and continue praying.
You'll hope and continue praying. Yes, that sounds to me as though there's some harmony between those two positions. Yes, and of course the dancing makes me think of the singing, which we've just heard. And of course I thought I could start all over again. I could start from a completely different position, if only I were half as musical as you. What about agnosticism and the chant of prayer? Does that resonate with you?
I think people are searching, and the search leads us to a healthy skepticism, or through a healthy skepticism. But somewhere along the line, there is the crossover between the mind and our reason and the soul. And does it matter? In the sense, you know, there's always this tension. And what does agnosticism mean? We're not talking about atheism. We're talking about I don't know what we're talking about. I'm here.
I'm just hoping somebody's going to tell me, because I've got to run this class.
The music is something that resonates. The music is the language of the soul, and I think that people can find that without even worrying about a kind of godness about it.
Now, if I were to borrow a single word from the parasha of the Shabbat, I would say I'd be lasata. Right? I'll oppose that.
Okay.
I'll counter that.
Yes.
By saying, the trouble with the music is that it's a shortcut to the sense of believing and certainty. And actually, whole bits of the self are left outside. And then I did say, you know, this is...
I'd like to... Okay, this is a wonderful discussion, but I'm not sure whether you want this discussion.
Well, I think I'd like to go with it another step, because people are still coming in, and I haven't had this discussion before in this way, so I would think it would be very helpful. So I put the count... I sort of countered this by saying that... The experience of the music in the liturgy speaks and can speak so powerfully to...
It is a language in itself.
Yes.
It actually that it almost needs no words.
Right. And then it bypasses the critical perceptive mind.
But that's where I would disagree.
Well,
I would then say it doesn't bypass the mind at all, because the mind is totally engaged with the soul through the medium of music, because music is not just a language of the soul, it's also a language of the intellect. And married with the text, because it has to be, and the text is the vehicle through which the music passes and carries, the music carries the text.
Yes?
I think it's that way. I
right,
think it's,
okay, so that's the, saying? That's the... the return of the satan. That's the counter Absolutely. Yeah. Yes. Yes.
I understand your point about the sata, but in support of your point, we will do it.
Yes. Okay. So that falls into that category that the enactment. You use the metaphor of the dance too, which would. Right. I will now start sort of from where I would have started if we hadn't had that conversation. Not in order to leave it behind, because I think it's absolutely integral. Have you heard? Perhaps not as much as I have in my role as the minister at Bromley Reform Synagogue here. The voice which says, I haven't joined a synagogue, I would like to join a synagogue, I'm da-da-da-da, one thing and another. Or sometimes it's the non-Jewish partner of in a family who said, well, I had been suggested to me that I might consider conversion, but, and this, at the end of this but comes, I don't believe. All right. And this I don't believe comes up as a big obstacle. And I think my response for a long time has been a not a very helpful one, and therefore I've had to repress it, which has been, it doesn't matter. Because in a way, that's exactly what the person doesn't want to hear, because what you're saying is the thing which is an obstacle to you doesn't matter to me, and that really doesn't take us anywhere, it seems to me. I'm not being much help. Sorry, you're going to...
Yeah, just a little point that I'm aware of lots and lots of Jewish people who don't make a big issue of it. They just say, I don't believe, but I still go to them, I still say the prayers and everything.
Yes.
And I don't know if anyone's actually made an estimate of how many those are, but I think it's a pretty large number. But it's, anyway, they regard being Jewish, going to synagogues, more important. So it's not an issue.
Comes back to that very original, one of the things you use the word clannish, tribal, social, whatever it's going to be, in feeling within the people. And
Tony, yes. Can I just tell you what happened to us when we joined Bromley 40 years ago, Martin and myself? Martin didn't believe, and David Freeman turned up on our doorstep in Bexley. We didn't know any Jews. We'd just come down from Leeds, moved in with two small children. Didn't know anybody, didn't even know where Bromley was. And David Freeman arrived one evening, our age as well, early 30s, and said, I'm the rabbi from Bromley Reform Synagogue, and I just wanted to say hello, would you like to come and join us? And got chatting, and Martin Swell said, well, no point in me coming, thanks very much for asking us, but I don't believe in God, there's no point in me coming. And David Freeman said to Martin, we're all at different stages of that, why don't you come along and talk about it with us? Martin, who had only ever had a rabbi say, you come to shul on Saturday or else, and that switched him off completely at the age of 13. Similarly, my son, I have to say, despite his Bromley reforms, then said to David, well, yeah, okay, if we're willing to talk, because Martin loves talking, I'll come along. And that was it. We got extremely involved. We were able to talk to David about all those things. And interestingly, David went on his own journey to become a psychoanalyst, which is
psychoanalyst.
So we went our ways and had extremely interesting conversations over many, many years and got very involved with the synagogue. So I think that answer to Martin at the time was, we're all at different stages of that, come along and talk about it, was such a wise one for a non-believer to hear. He felt, this is a different religion from anything I've ever heard about.
Yes.
We've been brought up in the world.
Yes. Let's put us a lot... Yes, please.
I'm a member of Bromley Catholic Synagogue, and I wonder myself why I carry on going on a regular basis, because I know perfectly well myself what I think, and I think, well, I shouldn't be there, but I shouldn't be anywhere, and there are large number of people who are like this. I think who are like this, because I can't understand why anybody should go in the first place. Right? So that, but I do find that the identification, right, because whatever I may think, I can't do anything about what I am. Right? And I think that this is the important part. And I do find that attending synagogue, taking part in services, strengthens my feeling that this, if I was going to pick any place, it, you know, this would be the place that I would pick.
Yes. This, if I don't believe in, let's complete whatever you like, let's say God, but this is the one I don't believe in, and these are the people with whom I want to share my disbelief. I mean, I think there is that. I mean, now I'm being quite serious there. I mean, I remember overhearing, some of you have heard this before, in a previous incarnation, if you'll excuse the expression, I was a teacher at a boys' school at St Paul's in West London. And for my sins and everybody else's, I did plays there. I directed plays there. And, you know, there's a long waste of time when people are sitting around waiting for the lighting man to get something fixed, you know. And there were a couple of boys, a Jewish boy and a Christian boy, sitting. So I was just privileged to their conversation, you know. And it's wonderful sort of, you know, listening in. Now, to cut it very short, the Jewish boy came across as a good, sound, Jewish, sceptical, disbelieving, but definitely not Christian, all right? And the Christian came across as a chap who really was doing his best to hold on to his faith, all right? And out of this came this interchange. So you don't believe in God? No, said the Jew. So you don't believe in Jesus then? And there's a big pause, and I thought, now what's he going to say? And he just said no. And I thought, well, actually, you've just given one to the other side, you know, because you. But I mean, it's in those interstices, in those spaces between all those silences. There's so much going on. Now I'd like to just sort of draw some of these things together, but I think there's one that you were about to.
I was going to say, I think a lot of people believe in being Jewish, but don't necessarily believe.
Yes.
Because a God at my ear who said, when asked.
Yeah, he just said being God, but I mean, you know, I know what he means.
Sorry, wow.
Well, actually, you might have touched on something rather significant there.
Yeah, I thought something about sparks of light emanating earlier.
Yes, so. Yes.
No, what I was going to say is that was this God at my ear who said, you know, when asked, do you believe in God? She said, no, but I believe in the Jewish people, and the Jewish people believe in God. So
yes.
I think there's that kind of
yes.
thing in Judaism.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I wouldn't have said anything else, but the last few comments have just really reminded me that the sort of discussion we're having is spot on. It's exactly what happened at the Second Aliyah in Israel 100 years ago, and I did a session at Leeds Limburg on this, and it was exactly this division between previously there'd been only religious people in Israel, religious Jews, and then you had the people from Russia and from Poland who came to Israel. And they set up the kibbutzim and they built the land of Israel as more or less secular Jews. They weren't Jewish, but they really were not believers in that sense. And there was this beginning of this divide between the religious and the non-religious. And it's amazing that sort of Jewish culture is very much there. It's quite amazing.
Yes. Now, that sort of lapsus linguae. I use the foreign expression for that. that slip, which wasn't a slip, really, I suppose, because actually, what you, in a way, what you equated the yourself and us collectively with is, as it were, and this is a word I am going to borrow, the incarnation of the divine in people. I mean, which is and it has its parallel in you know in a sister religion. Not, you know, just right beside us here, at least a certain theology there, where they grapple with the notion of the divinity of Jesus by talking about the, you know, the body of the living Jesus or Christ is the church, and the church is, if you'll excuse the expression, kalal goyim, if you like. as we talk about the, you know, Am Yisrael as being that embodiment of. Okay, so all of those, these are all sort of parallel and shifting issues. But the questions we face, nevertheless, I would say, is that we do have to go back to the respect of the other. When the person says, I do not believe, and they feel that that is standing between them and an engagement with Judaism, in fact, with joining the people, that's the problem, you see. There's, if cultural being culturally Jewish, it works, as it seems to in parts of the Upper West Side, for example, in New York, because of sheer numbers. Nevertheless, it still undergoes the same tensions. People are still asking, good Jews brought up in Jewishness, with a great sense of identifying with Jewish peoples, have evolved a whole series of secularized Judaisms, which are very well integrated in societies, sometimes very prominently, sometimes quite marginally. The United States and Manhattan is a very good case of a deeply integrated secular, I mean, talking about secular Jews there, where you can, as it would, and so you go on being Jewish by marrying people who are not Jewish, and you go on being Jewish by celebrating mixed cultures, right? And eventually you end up with various sort of hybrids which do, in the end, stop being, in any meaningful sense, distinctly Jewish. And the one that I've personally had to deal with, and some people might have said married into, is called Jewish Episcopalianism. And these are rather well-educated, cultural New York Jews for whom the temple is where you go for a dance on Friday night, but where you worship is the art gallery and the library and the university. Right? And the people you spend your time with, your Klal Yisrael, are people that you get on with and with whom the question of whether you're Jewish or not simply doesn't arise. In fact, the moment your Jewish identity, as it were, becomes something that you talk about, it's almost a disqualification, if you like, from this sort of secular Judaism, if you like. And there are various kinds, these sort of things going on. Then you get the very profoundly, if you like, tribalized or clannish Judaism, where people find that the only thing that holds them together can be the service. All right? And I'm not saying this in a disparaging way, but it's a very powerful thing. Now, but it can be very isolated, and it doesn't necessarily, it often speaks back to remembered. I'm just thinking how much some of the people talking as we came out of your session, how sad it was that they weren't brought up with that liturgy. You know, I mean, I think that's the point. And of course, one works to, in a sense, repair breaches, I think, but that's what we're talking about, isn't it, a lot of the time. We have to recognize the fact that for huge tracts of our numbers of our people, without this very careful, conscious effort, this is not something which in itself is enough to carry people through. It will carry through, it seems, quite a large number of Haredi and Hasidic Jews, perhaps. And that's what it looks like at the moment. But that isn't really coterminal with what, up until now, broadly, our Judaism has been, which has been a religion in the world, and it has not been a sect within itself. So without straying into those sort of politics, I think I would like to pose this question of agnosticism in this particular way. Put in a rather oversimplified way, but all the time you stay with a strictly traditional sort of service with very little in English. Right? There can be a benefit to not knowing much Hebrew, but being able to recite it for some of the reasons that we've had here. You have this, you dance it, you can sing it, you can have that sense of a distinct peoplehood because of it's a distinct language and so on. But, and also you're not, you don't face the difficulty of sensing how different your own, your real perceptions are, or your personal individual perceptions are from those collectively held ones in the liturgy. So the liturgy continues to sing beautifully of the gates of repentance being held open for just a few minutes, you know. But inside you, once you're out of that, they don't exist. Then you can say, well, why not pop down the road? Why not pop down the road to your reform or liberal school? Because they do a lot in English. And there you will actually have to confront, you know, the terms of belief and so on and so forth. Moreover, since for the last couple of hundred years they've been systematically reforming, they've been chucking out or drawing back or reinterpreting all the uncomfortable stuff. Mm-hmm. All right? So we will... I pass no judgment on this, but in our new Siddur, for example, sometimes at the end of our of Kaddish, we will say, Yisrael, but sometimes we will say B'nai Adam, and we will add them on as well. And in doing so, satisfy ourselves that we're being universalistic, right? But we're actually withdrawing something of ourselves from what Klal Yisrael has chosen to say. Now, it doesn't, it seems to me, it doesn't quite fit the bill for a lot of people. Maybe most of us in this room, one way or another, we've come here, we're finding our way. I think, though, that part of the problem is that we are stuck with people feeling in their conscientious selves, in their honest selves, when they really, the soul, as it were, which should be open to their God, all right, when they do that, when they approximate that, they say, I'm not sure what God, that doesn't mean anything to me. You know, I will do, I do my bit. I am prepared to be honest and open and reflective and so on. I can value the beautiful things that over centuries, trust in God, belief in God, faith in God, the perception of God's purposes and involvement in human affairs. I can appreciate the wonderful treasures of moral and cultural life that these have given reason to. On the other hand, I can also see some of the bad things that were permitted because we're human, by the use of that. So I am wary that it isn't all in itself to be trusted. But actually, for myself, I don't find it. And when I don't find it, I feel that I'm there under false pretenses. And I think that's the bit. It's the feeling of being there under false pretenses. The more I feel myself personally, this is the way I respond, other people respond differently, of course, but I think it's not unusual, the more I feel that drift, which we have within progressive Judaism, towards the conservative and the more orthodox expressions, even if we can't, our minds can't take us there, our hearts go there. Part of me says this is moving closer into the warm room where I will find what I'm looking for. And part of me says it's a drug. I mean, putting it, a very good one, a pretty safe one, perhaps. I don't know, pretty addictive one, actually, if you end up going to every service all the time and you're doing Musaf and second day eventually. But in a way, it is a way of placating the troubled spirit, not by answering it, but by actually sort of covering it over. Very constructively, I think. I mean, beautifully. And when I'm sorely tempted in that direction, it's usually when I'm uncomfortable with my doubts. That's how I would put it for myself. I thought also that there are one or two things that we say over and over again. Well, the second paragraph of the Shema, which states that if we do, then we get; if we don't, then we don't. Right? And there are ways in which we can reconcile this with our experience, and there are ways where we can't. When we reconcile it, we sometimes feel we have gone an awful long way to make this text remain true. Why have we not jettisoned the text? Well, I'll tell you. Reform did, for a little while. Well, about 30 years, really. Dropped second and third paragraphs out. They're there, but it's one. But there are other readings we can have. We've brought them back again. And what we've done is we've highlighted, or rather boldened, a few lines in it. It's smart. I know it came really, I think, largely from Rabbi Jonathan Magnet. Who spotted the singular and plural, if you do this, then you, etc. And he thought we will work with that, and it is a good thing. There is that. But nevertheless, there are plenty of people who say, but even if it were so, I'm not sure that's how I would want. That's not what my spiritual life is about. I'm not doing this so as to get. All right. The other one is, your love has never left us. With overflowing tenderness, we translate. You can translate it all sorts of ways, but essentially this is not a wrong translation. It's a translation. With overflowing tenderness, you have. if we could only mention just a few of the wonderful gifts and things you've done for us as a people, specifically as Jews, it says, you know, we can't even begin to recount them. And then there's a little voice inside a lot of Jews at the end of the 20th century, beginning of the 21st century, who are saying, yes, and I could barely recount some of the terrible things that we have not been spared as well. And I'm not sure in the end whether or not I want to do this kind of mathematics. I'm not sure whether I don't want to be shot of this whole business. Now, if I can sing Ahavat Olam and so on, you know, okay, fine. But the moment I think what actually that says, it's more, well, how can I, on the one hand, be among the upright when I know I'm twisting and turning, all right? And I'm revering something which is revered by my fellow Jews, and I want to stay with them, all right? But actually, should I? Are there others whose honesty and integrity I shouldn't align myself with out of preference? It will be a loss. I will be saying goodbye to something known and familiar. Now, if I say this is a... What am I doing saying this is a progressive rabbi? Well, all I'm saying is, I'm not saying do it. I'm saying that's what Jews have been doing. That's what Jews have been doing in a big way. The problem is, if we could just say it's only our lapsed, slack, nasty old Jews who've not wanted to love God and pray, right? Fact is, if that was the case, we'd say, well, good, farewell, bad rubbish, we shouldn't really think like that, but actually, no, what it proves is that stay with the faith and they'll be good people of integrity. What we also know is that an awful lot of good people of integrity are among those Jews who moved away. In fact, it doesn't seem to correspond, actually.
Yeah, I think, as a Reformed Jew of quite long standing, I think one of the one defect that isn't out of what we do with the new prayer book is that basically Reform, more so liberal, think of the whole thing from the basis of communal prayer, whereas the Orthodox Jew lays to fill in and will think of it a building towards it from a point of view of individual prayer, particularly if he doesn't go to shul for later. And that gives you something different. So when you have your communal prayer and festivals and Shabbatot, etc., you will have that an increase. But it is, I think, prayer should be individual, and really, as an individual, if you don't want to read the second paragraph of the Shema, all well and good.
Well, I hear what you're saying, and I think I'm sure that will resonate with a lot of people too. I think there's against that one could say that what you're describing, I think perhaps is fair, in that the majority of Reform congregants that I know see themselves as going to, you know, some Shabbats and high holy days pretty consistently, some of the festivals, probably their other praying, I don't know, I don't inquire very much, sometimes people tell me, but their own praying very often is in the form of meditative reading and reflection on not just the texts in our Siddur, which are the reflective, which are not, they can come from Kafka, they can come from all over the place, but equally, that shelves off into another kind of spiritual attention they pay to the world, which is a more eclectic and more secular, less spiritual concentration, which uses relatively little the poetry and the heritage, I mean, that collected heritage of Jewish liturgy. I think that's probably true. Equally, it may well be that a lot of Orthodox practitioners, Jewish practitioners in an Orthodox way, are, well, who knows what, you know, we don't know what, look after, you know, what a person's doing inside exactly, but from the outside what they may be doing is paying their dues. They are seeing themselves as paying their dues. They're doing the fixed prayer, and they're doing that because they see that as a religious duty, perhaps as a discipline, something, as somebody mentioned before, which in due course leads one closer, and so on and so forth. That's how it seems. I think I'd just like to, if I may, shift on, because the introduction has become the first half of the session, which I think is, I found it very interesting, because I've heard what I had to say already. now I've had some new stuff, which is yours, which is more interesting to me. I was surprised when I discovered when agnosticism as a notion first came about. And I'm wondering, what is your... silly trick, isn't it? When did agnosticism start?
I would think Socrates.
Socrates. Mm. Yeah? Before that? As soon as anybody was asked to believe something.
Enlightenment.
Hmm? Enlightenment, yeah. Mm. Yeah.
That's when it officially started.
Uh-huh. The word. When did the word start being used? But the Greeks didn't use it. A bit like telephone, also a Greek, but they didn't use it. It is very recent. Otherwise, why would I have said it? You know, and not only that, I can give you the date when it's a date. It's actually a day when it was used. Yes.
On that theme, I read something quite recently about religion in the 17th century, and it said anybody who expressed the view that God didn't exist is a bit like now being a paedophile.
they're just defective, actually. You're missing. You know, how can it be? Okay. Yes, I mean, many years ago, for my sins, this was something else, I was engaged in research in French Renaissance poetry, and what fascinated me was a poet who was also a prose writer, who was regarded as one of the earliest atheists in French culture, in the 16th century. And this was the first time that the word athée in French was used to mean not somebody who misbelieves, but somebody who doesn't even believe that God exists. So this is really what you're saying. Up until then, if you called somebody an atheist, you were calling, or it was like calling them, as if a Muslim were to say of me that I was an infidel. No, and it's not that I don't believe. He doesn't care what about that. What he notices or she notices is that I'm not believing the right things, and that's what an atheist was for quite a long time. Largely because any rational person would have to posit the existence of a supreme being, God. But, of course, it depended a little bit on how you described that God. All right? And if you didn't describe it according to, let us say, for example, at a certain period, the Catholic Church, and you happened to live in Christendom, you could be up for a roasting. Literally. It was that serious. They didn't ask you whether you believed in God or not. They asked you what you believed about God. And that was what it was all about. And that starts to crumble, actually, in the 16th century. It seems to crumble. Gradually, the notion of a purposeless or a non-teleological universe starts to come in. It's not to do with whether there is... And it's not to do also by... it's not a reversal to paganism, as though you're believing in the divinity of forces that are in some way not mastered by a single being, which arguably is what we are saying at one level, or were saying perhaps at one level in our Shema, which is the multitude of God beings are in Judaism the one God. There is something going on there, possibly. But that's not... So agnosticism is a word that was coined by Thomas Henry Huxley. He was born in 1825. He died in 1895, and he was born in Ealing. I just throw that in. Just shows you. Most unlikely place for agnosticism to arise is Ealing. Well, it didn't really rise in Ealing. He did. He was an expounder of Darwinism in his time, and he wrote in 1863 a book called Man's Place in Nature. And in it, he wrote essays on theology and philosophy from the viewpoint of, he called himself, an agnostic. And up until then, he had to explain what he meant by what an agnostic is. Now, if you go to a simple description of it in a the definition of it in a dictionary, which is I never recommend you to do that. It's always too superficial. But just to lay out the ground a little bit. Agnosticism is strictly the view, because we don't use it like that all the time, but strictly should be used, according to this, as the view that God's existence cannot be known. If you just think of where that's postulated, God's existence cannot be known. It doesn't say anything about whether or not God exists. It says about whether we can know about God's existence. Nor can it be denied. So if we believe it can be known, we're theists. If we believe that God, we can say that God does not exist, then we are an atheist. The term was derived, and it was derived by Huxley, from a New Testament usage in the book of Acts, and it was which referred to the unnamed God of the pagans. In fact, the Greeks and the Romans, effectively, they, as you probably know, they reserved a shrine for the unknown God. They worked on and it's quite hard to get into that thinking for us, I think, but not impossible. They had traditions of gods. They were aware that the same God went by a different name in different places. They also saw the gods as being rooted in a place, but nevertheless perhaps having an emanation of some or atavar somewhere else, and so may appear as Diana in one place and then be called something else somewhere, but essentially this was the same god. They sometimes defined very clearly, but they were not hot on heresy, rather like modern Hindus. They weren't too concerned that you were misbelieving, but they might be doubtful whether your God was really the same as their God, and therefore they would continue to use their own name. But in all of this, there was a feeling that there was probably a God out there that we hadn't sussed yet. That not everything was accounted for, perhaps, by the gods that we knew and worshipped. So, to, as it were, on the wise, safe side, why not have a shrine for the God whose name we do not know? And that is the origin in Huxley's thinking of agnosticism. Right? It was the God about which we don't know, but about which we cannot say it doesn't exist, or that it does exist.
If you start living under the ark, then maybe not an ark.
Can anybody answer that? When did we start doing that?
It seems a direct response to what you're just talking about.
What does it say? It says, "Know before whom you stand." But does it say who the God is before whom we stand? You see, when we redesigned our sanctuary, we put the words of the Shema up as well. We put that up. They were not going to eventually, but wiser counsels prevailed and said, you can't not do it, because unless you've got a good reason. And I didn't have a good reason for us not to do it. Nobody could think of a good reason not to do it. We decided to put the Shema up. So we thought, well, perhaps this might be indicating at some other place in the sanctuary what it, who it is. Before whom, isn't it? Not before what, before whom you stand. I don't know, what's the origin of that?
Why did they not want to do that?
Oh, just because we were modernising.
Oh.
We don't. Do we have to have it there? You know, it's a good question. I mean, you know, it is, because it is a tradition, and is it a tradition we want to maintain?
We actually, when we moved, did not put it up. We put something different up. And the reason was, it was suggested that why should we actually stand in the service looking at before whom we're standing? And in fact, we needed that on the way out of the synagogue. That's when we should be thinking
about what does Wimbledon have over the ark?
Serve God with joy.
Oh, yes, that's right. Yes, yes, yes. Right. Well, so on the one hand, so we're mapping this out. If we map it out in this sort of way, we've got theism, a belief in a single divine being, transcendent and personal, created the world yet distinct from creation. Transcendent, created the world but distinct. Right? This is theology. This is mind stuff. You know, it doesn't.
We do that too.
We do that too. but when we do this, we're doing this. I'm doing this mind stuff only really in the sense of clear the path, because I I would have to tell you, I don't think it helps to take us somewhere, but I can think it sometimes can prevent us getting somewhere. In other words, a lot of the theology, which is not really a Jewish science, I mean, it isn't really, it's an aspect of philosophy, really. It's more, it is in a broadly what we think of as the Hellenistic tradition. It's not something which... When did Jews start doing theology? Well, when they were challenged, really, by the church as to what they believed in. This really was to demonstrate that we were not heretical Christians. Effectively, the Western Catholic Church decided that it was clamping down on its heretics. It cleared up the Bonshommes. It clears up the Cathars, for example, because they were plainly heretical. Two aspects of God. They were like the Babylonians. The Jews presented a bit of a problem because, on the whole, one forgets this, before the 12th century, Christians lived close among Jews, and Jews lived close among Christians. And sometimes Christians found themselves being asked to believe a theology which they found very difficult. I mean, in a way, the straw that broke the Christians' back was the belief in the transubstantiation, that the wine became blood and that the wafer became it. This was very, very hard for many, many Christians to believe. And it seems as though they turned to their Jewish neighbours and said, you bless bread, you bless wine. When you do that, what happens to it? And the Jew says, well, taste some. I mean, it's wine, isn't it? I mean, you know, etc. No, we don't have a problem. And the Christian could say, I know. That's what we always thought. But now, apparently, it's not enough. You know, we have not to believe this, but we have to really believe it. Because if we really don't believe it, you know, we're, you know. For all sorts of reasons, I'm demonising the Catholic Church. Why not? If we can't do it at Linwood, when can we do it? But I mean, seriously. But we're talking about a moment in which heresy was at the top of the agenda. The problem was to separate the Jews from the Christians, because the influence was too difficult for the church in all sorts of ways. But the next thing was they had to answer the questions of Christians who said to their priests, but the Jews believe in God, but the Jews do this, the Jews do that, da da da. Aren't they, but you don't persecute them? So they had to find out what it was that made the difference between a Jew and a Christian. And the Jews understood that they also had to find out what it was that made the difference between a Jew and a Christian. All right. Now notice, you would have thought that it would have been obvious, because we are told all along, I mean, the Jews are the Jews, the Christians are the Christians. That's the point. We became the Jews, and they became the Christians as very distinct people. Before that, God-fearing people, people who read Scripture or didn't read Scripture, people who, there's an enormous sharing of belief. The Sanctus we were talking about, you know, I mean, when you hear Sanctus, 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 you translate it. I mean, I've had visitors to the synagogue who said, but it's just like the Mass, you know. Where does it come from? I said, well, where does the Mass come from, you know? But because the separation took place, well, that's when we started our theology. It was necessary to say, and Maimonides was among others was instrumental in saying, okay, let's have this is what it is to be a Jew. Right. Well, of those two things,
is that when the Jews were thrown out of England about time?
Well, no, that was an earlier time, it was Crusades time, but this separation really marks the beginning of the ghettoisation. That's when it really marks the expulsion of the Muslims from Spain, which involved the expulsion of the Jews. We think of the expulsion of the Jews from Spain, of course. But actually, the bigger thing was the expulsion of the Muslims from Spain, and we were caught up in that. It was kind of central to our history. It wasn't central to world history in the same way. Although,
what date was it?
Well, the expulsion from Spain is the end... 1492, by the end of the 15th century, essentially the Jews start to become ghettoized, and they go into ghettos, in doing so, and they stay there until Napoleon lets them out. I mean, come on, this is really you know, isn't it? I mean, but there you are. Essentially, this is what happens. There is this, that marking of separation, though, is in a sense something we have borne. since. It is something which we are struggling, we still have, we have to reconcile in the modern world, is that separation which was enforced on us as a people. It's a long time ago now, but it's the last 200 years, we really haven't, as a whole people, completely come to terms with the effect of that separation in all sorts of ways. We're still... that's when the tenets of our belief started to become sick. And that's when, in a sense, perversely, the answer we gave to the Christians was the answer we started to give to ourselves. Now, it was disagreed with. It was disagreed with. But let's just think of what some of those tenets are and what most compelling ones were for Jews, which was actually a belief in the world to come and a belief in the coming of Mashiach. These became tenets of belief, that a Jew was distinct from a Christian in one particular way, very particular way, and that was that whereas for the Christian, Mashiach had come, for the Jew, Mashiach hadn't come. And still today, many, many Christians actively see us as the people who are waiting for the Messiah. Right? And I think majority of Jews I meet, I do not see them as people who are on tenterhooks waiting for the Messiah. Right? Right? I mean, we do continually say, we say that kind of thing, and may he come sooner in our days, blom. But do you know what I mean? We sort of don't believe it because we know it's the way you should live as if you were going to bring the Messiah in the next minute, all right? But like experience tells you, but don't hold your breath, you know? I mean, I think that's the American expression that you add to the Hebrew expression. Speedily nowadays, but don't hold your breath, you know. And I think that is how it works very well. That and in fact the nature of the afterlife were the two areas which from the beginning were areas of Jewish religious agnosticism. Right? Everything else, on the whole, the rabbis, the authorities, the Jewish people went along with. The things that that God was a merciful God, that God was a personal God, that God did not have body, that God did not have limit, that God was not bound to the world in time and space, all of these things, all of this stuff, we had very little trouble with, partly because it was a theology which didn't impinge on a liturgy anyway. But it is a curious thing, isn't it? One of the tenets of our belief of our God, right, of our theism, all right, is that God has no body. How did we get out of Egypt? An outstretched arm. All right. You know, I mean, and in fact, pervasively through our liturgy and indeed through our Torahs, you know, God is given eyes. Every time he gets angry, his nose starts burning and flaring. You know, that's what it means. God's nose flared up. You know, it says that. So, in other words, the reality of our engagement with the divine was as if with a person. Melech, a king, a shepherd, a father, or this curious father of wombs, the merciful one, you know. And so it goes on. The presence, all right, not a very abstract thing, actually, because the presence shelters us under its wings. Actually, you've not only got God as person, but God as, you know, another kind of being as well. All of this stuff, you know, it's deeply Jewish stuff, all right? So, but we have in our principles the abstract notion of God. Which is the one that today people have most difficulty believing in? The God who has a nose, an ear to hear, and an eye to see, and a hand and an outstretched arm?
I think although you can't see or hear God, you can feel him in that way.
Him. Walk straight into that one. Theism insists on him, or he. Why? Because God has to be more than an it, all right? But actually, God doesn't have gender as well. I mean, that is part of the pure theology, the theism, all right? But what happens when you take We've taken it out of our liturgy, actually, this time. Our translation, not out of the Hebrew. We've taken him and he out of our liturgy. What happens?
Lots of things become plural all of a sudden.
Yes.
They become they.
Yes. Yes. And you don't have his mercy, you have God's mercy.
Right.
In English, of course. In Hebrew, it's...
I'm disturbed a bit by this literalism.
Yes.
Judaism was never, ever literal. These anthropomorphic appearances are part of a way that humanity has throughout the ages metaphorized, if for want of a better word,
yes.
its relationship with anything it could come to terms with and understand,
yes.
knowing full well
yes.
that it was not true,
yes.
literally.
Yes.
There's no question about that. So it doesn't matter whether it's wings or eyes or outstretched arms and all that. I mean, it's a metaphor for something great, or something that we don't know. And as far as gender is concerned, Hebrew is a language that is gender-based. And there isn't an alternative.
Yes, okay, that's fine.
So, you know,
absolutely.
Are you going to call God she? What difference would it make? So we have she's and he. I mean, look, the Kabbalists, when I won't, you know,
yeah,
you know.
Right.
I'm
of course, yes. So what you've said, I mean, is exactly, I mean, this is exactly, this leads us right into the heart of what I'm trying to, you know, explore for myself as a means of answering this question, but Rabbi, I don't believe. How can I come along? All right. As I say, you know, if I am able to offer Jewish religious agnosticism, all right, not only as a way into Jewish, let's inverted commas, belief, if you like, attachment to the faith tradition, all right. But I actually centralise it. I say this is not a clever little way of tricking you in. It's not a way. It is actually what we have always had, because that eye of God, that hand of God, we never said was a God with a hand or an eye. This was the bit of God that momentarily we encounter, that we perceive. Yes, it's the tail of the coat that passes. My back. You know, my face you shall not see. I mean, all of that deep metaphor, that mashal, the whole deep metaphor does exactly that. It prevents us, in a sense, from seeing a whole form. And this, in a way, is what our rabbis of the Christian Middle Ages were unable to do, at risk of their lives, really, which is to say, actually, what distinguishes us between us as Jews and you as Christians? Is that actually, from our point of view, you have strayed into idolatry, because you've actually given God not just the full form of a human being, all right, but you've even given him a name, a historical name, all right? And that is, by our book, idolatry. Now, the one thing you couldn't do as a medieval Jew was to say to the Christians, you're idolaters, right? Maimonides is the man who said, clearly, the Muslims are not. They do believe in the one God. In fact, he said, technically, even more purely than we do, because they refrain from too many of these mashalim, you know, these metaphorical speaking of God, giving in hands and eyes and so on. And he said, the Christians, we understand their mystery obliges them to believe also in the one true God. That's the sort of the way he put it, all right? But first of all, he didn't live among Christians, so therefore. But he drew them in because it was for safety. It was the security thing. The last thing you do is to say that the Christians are idolaters. What you do say, though, is that you have that your covenant, we have our covenant. That's where it's got to in modern times. But in doing this, in refusing, in a sense, to emphasize the point that we don't give God, as it were, a full description, I think we've made it harder for ourselves, for our own people, because there is a sort of assumption that we do, that somewhere in the, and this is for many Jews who are staying outside, there is an assumption that inside we have a sort of full totalizing description of God, that some Jews mysteriously comprehend God. Rabbi, you must, you know, I get it all the time. Not all the time. Not from believing Jews. They know, they're good Jewish agnostics, like me, if you see what I mean. They know how little they know about God, all right? And they know that part of this struggle of Israel, this struggle in the Jewish people, to be in the presence of this unknowable, but nevertheless presence, present God, you know, is somehow what we've been about for a very long time.
So you believe that the point that we're in faith, as it were, right, is that we have faith, right?
I would put it this way. I've got a little manifesto coming up here. It's not my business to give you a manifesto, but it's a way of, the way I've tried to pull some of these things together for myself, and it may be of use to you. Or it may just show you the path you really don't want to go down. But to some extent, I would say that what is called, and it's only been called this, really, could have been called this for just over 140 years or so, is agnosticism. Actually, that is, in a sense, what Jewish faith is. We have faith, emunah, in the worthwhileness of maintaining this relationship, this covenant. And on the other side, we're on one side of this. We're one partner in this covenant. And on the other side, right, is something that surpasses us, is eternal, all right, and is so great that the eternal one, has the capacity to be personal and on our scale with each one of us. Or as Shakespeare would say, you know, could even watch the sparrow fall. I mean, in other words, if God is God, then actually, that's not the problem. It's our problem. Once the number gets above about 15,000, I'm lost. I have to start again. You know, not so. Agnosticism, in a way, is what it is Jewish humility. All right, that's the smallness. In the one pocket, you know, I'm dust. I'm a worm. All right, that's the humility. I don't know. How can I know God? Or it's the Tevye the milkman stuff. I mean, I know it sounds simple. You know, I'm just being sentimental, but it is. Or better still, Woody Allen's father. When Woody Allen, in one of his characters, I know Woody Allen's not very acceptable anymore, but he is in my house, and or at least his early films are. He says to his father, but what's the meaning of the Holocaust? And his father says, words to the effect, listen, I don't even understand how a light bulb works. All right, but that's not a reason to say that there isn't a reason, that there isn't, it isn't known, you know. Why do we aspire to be, you know, clever pants? Jews aspire to be clever. I mean, really, to know, to explore, to find out, right? Because we're not going to overcome God like this. There's always going to be more, you know. We just don't want to be too far behind.
So it's all right for me, then? Just to say, well, yes, I'm Jewish, but I don't believe.
Yes, yes. If you said, I'm Jewish and I do believe, all right, my next question would have to be, and what do you believe? And that's the one that sends shivers up my spine. When people say, Rabbi, you know, I pray to God every day. And God, is God telling you to do something? Yeah. In my room, I've got an emergency switch. If I press that, the police come if I'm on my own in the building. All right? They're the ones I'm afraid of, the God knowers. Right? Okay. What I'm unhappy with, happy with people who feel bereft of God, that there is no possibility of God in their life, that there is just a nothingness beyond them, you know. But for people who find that when I go to the High Holy Place, or when I'm with, you know, or when I'm, you know, at the Seder table, that's when I know, you know, and I think the rest of my life I should be doing a bit more to try and find out a bit more about this. You know,
so,
for me,
what
these
you
are.
Know at that point is you know that you are Jewish. You know that. You're very conscious of that. You don't know why.
I think the why in that is worth going. I think you should, if I may say so, forgive me. You know, you might do well to think that when you say, I know I'm Jewish, that actually there's a lot of baggage in that. And one of those things is what you're saying is, and I haven't got all the answers. All right? And those other Jews that I'm davening with, my hunch is, like me, they also wonder. And when they read some of those words in our liturgy, they're also saying, it's a funny kind of love that I'm praying about here. We are in relationship to that liturgy. That liturgy is challenging us. And that liturgy is, it has become this wonderful, I mean, on the one hand, I love singers because it's got that huge self-confidence. It is the orthodox anthology of prayers. Right? But you know, also it isn't. It's also something which is verging, we're always verging on idolatry. Jews, this is our problem. Right? We have to keep the category open, the vacant category. We mustn't put a god on that pedestal. I know that it's almost like the Trafalgar Square. There's one pedestal they can't think what to put on, all right? In Judaism, that pedestal was right in the middle, right? It was called the Ark. We have to carry that Ark with us, and we have to keep that pedestal empty because people always want to put things on it. Now, one of the things we might put on it is Halakha, or the Torah, or Singer's Prayer Book, or Lewontovsky, or whatever it is. I mean, all these things that are hugely important to us, our problem is that we mustn't ever, it seems, if you're going to stay Jewish, make one of those, as it were, the object of our devotion, subject ourselves to one of those. Because idolatry, I read, is the worship of a figment of the human imagination. Right. Now, for example, our liturgy, our prayer tradition, probably, if you read Hoffman, it started as a sort of jazz, if you like. I mean, he puts it there because he's an American. He would, but why not? It sounds as though it was, it's a series of piyutim, of openings and closings of prayers, of a broad definition of the territory of prayer, And over time, people arrived at beautiful formulations, and then they sang them, and that became, another reason to hold them in position. And we don't want to lose them, right? But the trouble is, all of this comes at a cost. It starts to become, look like the answer rather than another formulation of our question. We are a question that God posed to himself. It's one way of looking at it. And the moment we are that question, we're not the answer. We have to stop, don't we? Shall I just quickly, is there time for me to give you this quick,
yes,
this little manifesto? Agnostic prayer, Jewish agnostic prayer. The dignity, worth, and intellectual integrity of agnostic prayer, I thought. It recognizes the need we have to address one-to-one with the wholeness of our being, the entirety or wholeness or unity of the other, that which lies beyond us, before us, within us, precedes us and succeeds us. It appeals to the echoing response or the reciprocating response that our own need and being postulate in that which is beyond us. We think there must be something that will answer us beyond us. Right? We have that need to believe that. We need to trust in that. And that is where agnostic prayer places us. It doesn't presume to name, to define, to understand, and to subdue the unruly proliferation, exuberance, and might of the being of the universe. It doesn't take refuge in idolatry, the worship of a figment, however subtle and refined, of the human imagination. So the strategy for entering the Siddur, and I think entering a Siddur, which is like a palimpsest, written over and over and over and over again and built up, a palimpsest of meditation and study, of appeal and prayer, and also placation, out of our fear that what we're involved in life is also a frightening thing which can overwhelm us at any time and does sometimes. That we should embrace the discordance. We should embrace that which doesn't feel right in the prayer book, which produces the gap between what we do hold and do believe and what is being said that we don't. That we should enter that space, we should explore that space, because that's the bit of us that we still have to grow into. We don't have to accept what the prayer book says, right? But we have to be in relation to it and feel the distance. Say, feel the pain, but it's not actually painful on the whole. It's very beautiful. It's that space between the liturgy, the fixed liturgy, and our own inquiry that we can actually encounter the other. I thought it was a bit like letting go. You know, you're in a friend's house that you don't know very well. You're staying overnight. You can't find the light switch, and you've got to go to the lavatory. It happens to us at a certain age, and it's a wide hallway, and you know you've got to get down it, right? And you can feel this wall, and you can feel that wall, but you can't feel them both at the same time, right? But you work out that you're going to have to go down that corridor because it's somewhere down there, not this way, because that's where your bedroom is, and that's not the bathroom. So you're going down to the bathroom, all right? And you have to let go of the wall from time to time. You have to be in the unknown space, right? Because otherwise, you're just going to wet the bed. You've got to get down that corridor, all right? And you have to let go of the wall on either side to make your way down, all right? And somehow that seems to be part of that. That is what it is, perhaps, and has been for a long time, to be a Jew. Thank you. Thank you. Yes. You've got to want to do it. Yes. You've got to feel the need to do it. You've got to locate. Haven't you? Isn't that what our yearning is? Thank you very much.
Yeah. I teach 12 and 15 years at Wimbledon.
Where do you come from? Miriam?
Yes, I'm at Wimbledon.
Yeah, I know you are. Sort of,
where
yeah.
do I come from originally?
Yeah.
Oh, should I make him guess?
Yeah, no.
That's unfair. I grew up in Kansas.
It's Kansas.
Kansas, okay.
Yeah. I teach, I shouldn't say this in front of my head teacher, I teach the 11 to 13 year olds.
Yes.
And I tell them that in many ways, looking at, you know, my mind is whatever, but in many ways, to be an agnostic is a definition of a Jew.
Yeah.
Actually, it was an observation that I could have made in the session, but there wasn't time. You know the law of return, they've reviewed it again in Israel, and they haven't changed it. But you know what they have in the law of return? It's the definition of a Jew.
Somebody who doesn't have another religion.
No, they use the Nazi definition.
Oh, yes.
And lots of people, Orthodox, can't believe that. How outrageous.
Yes.
But after the Holocaust, you can't.
Absolutely.
Any Holocaust survivor.
Mm-hmm. That's what we're here for. If we can't take in the people who are being persecuted as if they were Jews, even if they're not.
Yeah.
Right. So what are we doing?
And it's very interesting in Israel now. They haven't been able to. And of course, lots of people, Russian Jews who came, and lots of other Jews, they go there, but they can't get married.
Yeah.
We'll sort that out in time.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you very much.
We may have to Judaize Cyprus,
yeah.
but we'll do it that way.
Yeah.
I just wanted to ask you very briefly. Would you mind emailing me the definition that you did at the end? Because I'd like to go through
it. I'll
try
and put it together properly.
Please,
because
I'd like to have, because he's always not here. His excuse is that he's got his arm in plaster and
he thought he'd be knocked over
by these hordes of people.
Yeah.
Some excuse.
You know Judith Devlin? She had to she had to have her shoulder sorted out.
No.
Years of it. And she's got to go around for months with this thing on.
I didn't know.
Oh, yes.
I could recall.
Yes. So I'm, you know... These things can take a long
time.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I told him it was an excuse. I said, yeah. Anyway, but I really would love to actually study it in more. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much. That's so nice to be here.
Well, this last week I had to do the partial explanation on the red heifer, and I came across something that the Bobbitch Rabbi said.
Oh, yes.
In fact, I found it enlightening, because what he said was this, that you look for the meaning of something, right? Some of the laws tell you what to do and how to behave, right? And some of the laws are fairly simple, you know. So you make a bracha, you do as you're told. Right? And some of the laws, you do them,
yeah.
Right? And if you get to the stage where you realise that all of the laws really are in that category, Yes, I thought it was a wonderful thought.
But if you think you know, you've got it beaten why you're doing it. You haven't got there yet.
That's right.
Yes.
Yes, well, thank you very much.
Thank you indeed.